I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the children who fall through the cracks and find that there are few people there to catch them. A powerful and moving new documentary, Children of the Dumping Ground, tells the story of one such boy, an enduring fellow named Justin. We will talk about Justin's story and the lives of other children in similar situations with my guests, the documentary's producer, Karen Grau, and Jim Dalton, president and CEO of Damar Services. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is wfyi. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about a marvelous new documentary called Children of the Dumping Ground. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are the documentary's producer, Karen Grau, and Jim Dalton, who's the president and CEO of Damar Services. And I should start by saying, as you probably can tell by the intro I have given, I really enjoyed your film, the documentary, Karen. And I was going to try to set it up because it's really a story of a really, the only word I could come up with to describe Justin is endearing.
Absolutely. I think that's a perfect description.
But I'd like you to walk through kind of who Justin is so that we can talk about that. And we'll talk about how you found the story and some of the contours of what his story is.
Sure. Justin actually right now is a 19-year-old boy who is at Damar Services. But when I met him, or actually found him, if you will, he was a 14-year-old boy who was inside one of Indiana's maximum security juvenile prisons, Pendleton Juvenile Correctional Facility. And I've been filming in these particular facilities for about 17 years. And when I met him, I knew he really was like no other boy that I had met doing this line of work for so long. He actually is a boy with an IQ of 40. He has suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, several other disorders. He is developmentally disabled and intellectually disabled. And for me, you know, when I met him, the first thing I thought was, how is this child in a maximum security juvenile prison? And really, that's where the heart of the documentary began.
And how, without giving away too much, because mm-hmm. I know you do want people to actually watch the film.
Yes.
you know, how did he get there? Because you're right. You see this thing, and I will say at the beginning mm-hmm. of the documentary, part of what makes it so powerful is there's all of this turmoil around him that mm-hmm. you capture, and he is like this, you know, just perfect image of innocence dropped into it.
Absolutely.
How did he end up, though?
His life in general actually is somewhat of an odyssey. He was the victim of abuse at a very early age, and he had a touch point with the child welfare system, the Indiana child welfare system. But at the time, because his functioning level was so low, he was not considered really a credible witness, if you mm-hmm. will, to his own abuse. And so there were very little services provided to him early on. When you fast forward in his life to when he was 12 years old, he was still obviously suffering greatly from many disorders. And he was homeless at the time with his mother, but he was homeless at the time. And he came into the system on really what's considered a minor offense. I won't give it away here today because I think it's one of the more powerful revelations in the film. He came into the system on really a minor offense, which actually transitioned him from the child welfare system to the juvenile justice system. And we see that a lot in this arena. They're called crossover children, if you will. That's the jargon that's used, where they start out in the child welfare system as victims of abuse or neglect, and then later on in life, they find themselves in the juvenile justice system because they've either, you know, run away or committed some sort of offense. With Justin, he committed a minor offense, and when he did that, the person that he committed this offense against called the police. The police came, he was arrested, and that started the domino effect, if you will, and what really ensnared him in the juvenile justice system. He had a court hearing. He did not have any legal representation at that court hearing. He had no guardian ad litem. There was really no one there for him at all. And because there are so few places or so few options for children of this nature, sadly, the juvenile judge in his case sentenced him to the Department of Correction. You know, personally, after covering these issues for so many years, I really kind of found that egregious, if you will. I couldn't understand how a boy with that severe of a level of functioning could be sentenced to, to juvenile prison, but he was. And therein started the documentary. So he was sentenced to one particular juvenile facility, Pendleton, as I said before, because of the medical facilities Pendleton has there, and they thought that they might be able to work with Justin perhaps better than some of the other facilities. But once he got there, he really deteriorated very, very rapidly. Just was an awful, awful place for a 14-year-old child with a 40 IQ.
Yeah, and we probably ought to establish, I mean, part of the problem was, as you say, it's a very minor offense. I won't give that away.
Right.
But I think the title sort of implies what was the real problem with Justin, and that is that there was no one to speak for him at any point. That we've got, I hope I'm not giving anything away
from the
film here, but we've got this 14-year-old kid with an IQ of 40, 42, somewhere around there, who, you know, is functioning at best at like a first or second grade level.
Right.
And he gets dragged into the legal system without anybody advocating for him in any way. And nobody, I mean, one of the heartbreaking things is that clearly, you know, there's no family that connects with him. So can you talk a little bit about the circumstances that left Justin so isolated in the world?
Sure. It surprised me somewhat that he did not have legal reputation, although I will tell you, I have filmed dozens and dozens and dozens of cases over the years where children and families have no legal representation. They are offered it many times, but many times they either, you know, they refuse to have a public defender because they find out that their case might be set aside and it's going to take even longer to go through the system. And a lot of times they just want to get their court hearing over with. That was not the case with Justin. he did not have legal counsel. I was probably more surprised that he didn't have a guardian, you know, someone to advocate on his behalf. Obviously, when you have at the time, I think when he was going through court, he was 12 or 13. If you're operating at the level of a first or second grader, there is no way you understand what's going on inside the courtroom. And so really, from a legal perspective, it's unconscionable that you could let a child, you know, labor through a court hearing like that, having no idea what's happening to him, and then suddenly being shipped off to juvenile prison. I will tell you, we just recently on Sunday, we had a private premiere of the film, and we did find out some good news about that particular issue regarding legal representation for children that we can get to later. But that's really how he came into the system. You know, we did give the judge in his case, who's now retired and living in Florida, we did give him a chance to discuss how it was he felt that it was appropriate to sentence Justin to the Department of Correction. I will tell you, he did not agree to an on-camera interview, but he did send a response via email, which I also quite frankly found quite disturbing. Mm-hmm. You know, he mentioned that he really didn't remember any of the cases in his 18 years as a juvenile judge. And I know I've worked with many, many juvenile judges, mm-hmm. not only in Indiana, but across the country. And I've never heard a juvenile judge say that. As a matter of fact, the juvenile judges that I've worked with, many here in Indiana, say just the opposite. That, you know,
they're haunted by
they are completely haunted by the cases that they've, you know, been responsible for, or children who's, you know, they've been entrusted to their care. And so I found that probably as disturbing as anything during the 4 years that we produced and filmed this documentary. So I think what it does when you talk about children of the dumping ground, mm-hmm. really the title comes from people telling me this over the 4 years that these prisons and detention centers have become the dumping ground for children that really have nowhere else to go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are no or not enough placement facilities for these kids who start falling through the cracks.
Yeah, the superintendent at Pendleton says during the documentary that the real reason Justin's there is because that's where the state had a bed for him.
Absolutely. It was literally, according to the judge, the only place for him. I would somewhat argue with that, but I guess that's another documentary for another time.
Well, and I want to talk about the larger issue at some point, but I'd like to, you know, do Justin the courtesy and, you know, honor the kind of responsibility to keep the focus on him at least for a few more minutes.
Sure.
And Jim, if we could talk a little bit about, you know, these kinds of experiences, the post-traumatic stress disorder, the abuse, the abandonment, and all of that. What does that do to any child, much less one that starts out with special needs?
Yeah, it's a complicated issue, and the challenges that we see with these children occur certainly more often than we'd like to see in our society these days. A lot of these children, at least when they come to Damar, they have had experiences in their lives that many of us could not even understand, experiences of physical abuse, sexual abuse, abandonment, neglect, and they are quite vulnerable to adults, peers. And so their experiences are significant. And what we know about those kind of experiences with these children is that there's a profound change socially and even neurologically with these kids at certain points in their life when they have these experiences. The ways that we all develop coping, that's interrupted with them. And this is imprinted on their brains for a long time to come. So there is a lot of healing that's needed, a lot of specialized supports that need to be provided. And it with these types of children, it can be a slow process.
We are talking about a new documentary, Children of the Dumping Ground, but really a much larger subject of the kids who fall through the cracks. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Jim, if we can, when we talk about the kind of specialized support, you know, for example, what kinds of things did Justin need?
Sure. I mean,
what would help? Ended up helping him.
Yeah, Justin had a lot of needs when he came to us. When we first met Justin, he had difficulty even sitting still, standing in one place. He disrobed often. He just had no sense of coping. He had no sense of personal boundaries. He was very, very impulsive, mostly neurologically based on his developmental condition. So there are a number of areas that we need to develop a plan with him that were really social skills training, coping skills, educational skills, all things that we had to use behaviorally based services and programs with him. We're going to talk to Justin and ask him how he feels and those kinds of things. So those aren't really impactful for kids with these kinds of disabilities. So it's really behaviorally based. It's really reinforcing and doing repetitive training in a supportive way where they can develop more pro-social skills. And so we did a lot of that with Justin in a lot of different areas.
How did you start that process? Because In watching the documentary, he started out, I mean, you could tell, the fear and the lack of trust just radiated through the camera.
Yeah, and that's a big important. You can't really make any progress until there's some kind of safety and trust. So safety is always first. And with Justin, we had to gently move into that. And, you know, Justin was lucky, even at the Department of Corrections, to have some significant relationships with other people where he felt safe and had a cornerstone of reference. And that's what first we had to do with him at Damar.
We are talking about the children who fall through the cracks in honor of a new documentary, Children of the Dumping Ground. My guests are documentary producer Karen Graw and Jim Dalton of Damar Services. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about a new documentary, Children of the Dumping Ground, and really the larger subject of children who fall through the cracks here in Indiana and to some degree across the country. My guests are the documentary's producer, Karen Graw, and Jim Dalton, who's the president and CEO of Damar Services. Well, we were talking really about a young man named Justin, who's the focus of the documentary. And, you know, I mean, the overarching, this is a young man who had is developmentally, intellectually disabled, had an IQ of about 40, 42, and at the beginning was functioning at a first or second grade level. And his real offense in life seems to be that, you know, everyone abandoned him.
Right.
Not, you know, his family, to some degree, as Karen established, the legal system, you know, all of the people who were supposed to be looking out for the innocent in our society either took off or looked the other way. And I guess I'd like to, it's one thing, obviously, if Justin's story is an isolated one.
Right.
But, and just that fluke, but Karen's already shaking her head, indicating no. So, you know, do we have an idea how many of these kids there are?
Well, when I started researching this topic, the statistics were hard to come by. But one thing we do know is that children with intellectual and developmental disabilities do come into these systems at a disproportionate rate than other children. We know that they are four times as likely as children without disabilities to be sexually abused, which Justin was. We know that individuals with these disabilities comprise about 3% of the general population, but they comprise over 10% of the U.S. prison population. So that gives you some idea of what we're dealing with here and really the magnitude of the issue. I found it wrenching because I think that because these confines are closed, the public doesn't get to see what goes on inside juvenile court. They don't get to see what goes on inside our juvenile detention centers and facilities. And while there are some very good, hardworking, dedicated, caring people in these confines, I think a lot of times because the public doesn't know the types of children that end up being there, we just don't pay enough attention to the issues. And then that translates into a lack of legislation on behalf of these particular kids. And so during the research of this film, it really made me realize that the public needs to have a better understanding, not only of what our juvenile population as a whole is, because for the better of 15 years, most of the kids that I've been filming are kids who come from at-risk backgrounds and have had many touch points with the juvenile justice system. But then when I met Justin, I realized there was this whole separate population of children with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And so I think we're just now getting to the point where we're doing more brain research nationally and finding out more about these issues and the stressors that these particular kids have. And so it's my hope that in the future we'll see better statistics gathering, if you will, of these types of cases. But right now it's very difficult, other than sort of a broad range that I just talked about, the percentages of exactly how many children like Justin are in the system. When I gave the statistic earlier that over 10% of the U.S. prison population is comprised of individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, what I then found out was, because we don't know the exact number, they do know that there are even more children versus adults in the system with these disabilities. So 10% is a low figure when it comes to kids.
And I guess I mean, to some degree, I think most people listening to this are thinking, okay, we let an intellectually disabled, developmentally disabled kid, A, go in front of a court of any kind without counsel, without legal representation or anyone to speak for him. That's one issue about, you know, what sort of protection should we put in place. But then the larger question is, let's assume, you know, there are offenses and that these kids have done things that at least temporarily they should be removed from society to see if their behavior can be redirected. What should we be doing to make sure that there are better options than throwing them into facilities for violent offenders? Jim, I'm going to start with you on that one. What do the kids like Justin need? If we're going to do a state-driven, if nothing else, just a state-driven triage center rather than an ultimate destination, what would be some solutions?
Sure. I certainly have some thoughts on that. One of the things we know makes a difference with these children is to upfront have a good evaluation or an assessment of their skills and abilities. Many of these children that appear before the judges without certain kinds of information, the judges are not sure where they're functioning, and they assume that they're functioning at levels that they see with most of the kids that appear before them, which is high levels of antisocial behavior and high levels of delinquency. So a commitment from the state to provide good comprehensive assessment of the children's histories, their needs, their IQ levels, their sensory issues and challenges, and get a good diagnostic understanding of them would be one good way to start, so that these needs don't go by the wayside or go on unrecognized.
We are talking about a powerful new documentary, Children of the Dumping Ground. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Karen, how much of this, the testing, how much of this is a money problem? I mean, I don't want to steal from the power of your documentary, but if you do the math on what turned out to be the solution for Justin, I mean, that came to about $125,000 a year.
It's expensive, but I like to look at it as an investment versus an expenditure, if you will. Mm-hmm. I think that, for us to say that these children are not worth spending our resources on is really penny-wise, pound-foolish. Because if you don't take care of these issues at the front end, you're only going to be paying more at the back end. And after 17 years of doing this work, I can say that, I see this time and time and time again, that when these facilities, these detention centers and prisons become the dumping ground for these kids, while it might be cheaper, so to speak, a juvenile prison, for example, costs taxpayers about $125 a day for a juvenile offender. And when you look at what services they do or don't get in a juvenile facility, you have to weigh the pros and cons. Mm-hmm. Because if they're not getting the services that they need when they're behind bars, and then we release them back into the community and oftentimes back into the neighborhoods where they were languishing in the first place, you're only going to be spending more money, because chances are that they're going to get in trouble again or they're going to fall through the cracks again, and then you pay and pay and pay. And so,
the human cost as well.
The human cost is, yes, it's astronomical. And so, while, places like Damar, yes, you know, I hate to use the word expensive because I don't consider it expensive when you're getting extraordinary outcomes and extraordinary care. And if that ultimately is what leads to not only a better life for the children who are entrusted to their care, but leads to a better community overall, then that's an investment we need to be willing to make. And we need to be very vocal, I think, with our legislators and our politicians to say, here's why these resources are needed. Here's the before. Here's the after. Let's weigh the cause and effect and, you know, make smart decisions.
And I think to go on that theme and to stay with Justin for a little bit longer, I'm going to ask you, having seen that, I guess I'm one of the privileged few who has had the chance to see the documentary already, and having seen it, not to disparage any of the good people who work with Jim at Damar, but it seemed to me the real hero of Justin's story was Karen Frazier.
Oh, Kate Frazier.
Kate
yes.
Frazier, I'm sorry.
Yes.
I got the, and you could tell, I mean, the concern, all of that just bled right through the screen that she had for him. So I guess what I'm going to ask you to do, and maybe have Jim come in on the back end of this, without that kind of intervention, without somebody who cared that much about this one boy, where would Justin be right now?
You know, it's an excellent question, and it's a scary thought. Kate Frazier, for those who haven't seen the documentary yet, because it hasn't had its worldwide premiere, mm-hmm. but it will in 2015. Kate Frazier was one of Justin's counselors at Pendleton Juvenile Correctional Facility. And I should add that it's Kate Frazier and Mike Dempsey, Mike Dempsey was the superintendent of the prison mm-hmm. at the time. He is now the head of, he is the executive director of youth services for the Indiana Department of Correction. And he's in charge of all juvenile services. It was really those two who, when Justin came to the prison, said, you know, this isn't right. We do the best we can with the kids who are sent here, but this is a child that should not be here. We are not equipped or prepared to take these types of children. But that said, they had no other option. He was court ordered to the prison, so that's where he was going to be for an extended period of time. And Mike Dempsey and Kate Frazier just took it upon themselves to say, here's what we're going to do. We're going to have one person with him at all times, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that responsibility fell to Kate Frazier. And she wouldn't call it a responsibility. She would call it a privilege. And I was so happy to be able to capture some of that while we were filming. Because it's people like Kate and people who work in these very difficult confines where if that's your job every day to come in and face those wrenching situations with these children, that's, you know, it takes a Herculean effort to, you know, emotionally get through that yourself professionally, let alone make sure that the children who are, you know, counting on you for support are doing well. So, yes, you're right. Kate is a hero in the film. She has continued on and off to keep in touch with Justin. You know, and this mm-hmm. was all told, this was a 5-year documentary mm-hmm. in the making. So there were a lot of people who ended up becoming a safety net for Justin. Mm-hmm. And we're thankful for that because that doesn't always happen. That's not always the case. There are just too many kids in too many facilities and not enough people to be able to offer that kind of support.
Jim, can you talk a little bit about where Justin would be right now if there hadn't been that kind of intervention?
Yeah, it's difficult to think about. As Karen mentioned, the relationship with a primary person, a primary mm-hmm. adult in someone's life is so important. And as Karen said, as he's transitioned across through the years, he's been blessed with.
Yeah, there was a guy at Damar as well, Mr. Fred.
Mr. Fred.
Loves Mr. Fred.
Another star of the show in addition to Kate for sure. But I think what happens with these kids when they don't have that safety, they don't have that security, they don't have that ability to form what we call self-efficacy, which is, hey, I maybe can take this step forward because I was successful in the past, or I can take this step forward because I know that Kate loves me. And if I mess up, Kate will be there for me and we'll go forward. Without that, what happens is the kids, either if they're cognitively able to, they can give up. They can it creates more anger and turmoil. And then their behavior can become even more maladaptive, which then is a vicious cycle. More charges, more community maladjustment. So I can say with confidence, because I've studied this case and seen it, is without Kate, without Mike Dempsey, without Karen Graw, without Christine Blessinger, and without the wonderful folks at Daymar, this would be a totally different outcome for this young man, and it probably would not be positive.
We've gotten a question via Twitter from a listener named Tom, and if you would like to reach out to us or send us a tweet, you can do so at WFYI. You also can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or if you want to go old school and just call us, you can call us at 8. Oh, forget it. I'm going to go straight to the question. It says, isn't school even cheaper than juvenile prison?
Very well stated. Yes, it is. And that really gets into a whole nother topic that that my company, Calamari Productions, has been working on as well, and that's called the school-to-prison pipeline. Yes, school is much cheaper. Unfortunately, we find, again, that children with emotional disorders are disproportionately being expelled or suspended from school because they present challenges inside the classroom that a lot of times schools and teachers and administrators aren't prepared for or aren't, you know, able to deal with. So we find a lot of times, I could tell you, you know, an unscientific statistic after 17 years of interviewing thousands of kids in the juvenile justice and child welfare system, that the vast, vast majority of kids that I've filmed with over the years have been expelled or suspended multiple times. And so their experience in the education system is one that's been chaotic. And a lot of times by the time they get to middle school, that's usually kind of the cutoff point, if you will, where they start falling off the cliff. And they just feel that they're so far behind that they'll never catch up. And then there's a feeling of hopelessness. And then education becomes secondary instead of primary. I know when we were doing research for the film, I read a national survey. This was from the most recent one I could find was from 2005. This national study showed that 20% of youth with emotional and behavioral disorders were arrested while in secondary school. So the school issue, that's a great question. The school issue is really, you can't talk about juvenile justice without talking about education as well. The two go hand in hand.
And that's not really a conversation we're having right
that's
now.
That's right.
I mean,
I could go off on all sorts of tangents.
I'm saying it's a conversation we probably should have because it is related to this subject. When we talk about education in this state right now, we're really focused on the upper tiers and improving achievement. And kids like Justin are never going to be CEOs. They're never going to be, you know, vying for the Nobel Prize in the sciences or anything like that. But they're human beings and as such deserve same consideration everyone else does. What sorts of things, Jim, should we be doing at the educational level to intervene more early and provide the Justins with the opportunities they need so that they don't start down this path in the first place?
Yeah, and I think in Indiana, our schools are doing a better and better job of trying to identify early and have early intervention. Of course, the special education law requires schools to do that. I think the challenges that we see are that these kids continue to fall through the cracks in public schools and in private schools because there's challenges about how do we actually serve them, what does it cost. So again, I think a commitment as much as we can have that in our public schools toward kids with disabilities and what we provide to them and how we provide that it's practical, that it makes sense in their life and involves their families is the most important thing we can do as early as possible.
We are talking about the most vulnerable among us who fall through the cracks, Children of the Dumping Ground. It's the title of a new documentary. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about a new documentary called Children of the Dumping Ground that explores the way that some of the most vulnerable in our society can fall through the cracks and find no one there to catch them. My guests are the documentary's producer, Karen Graw, and Jim Dalton, who's the president and CEO of Damar Services. We were talking just before the break about the sorts of interventions and all of that. We probably ought to talk a little bit about where Justin is now in his life. Karen, I'll start with you, but I want Jim to chime in.
Yes. You know, I'm happy to report we've done, Calamari Productions has produced about, I think we're at 30 documentary films now on child welfare and juvenile justice. And Justin, thankfully, is a subject and a boy that turns out as well as I could have ever hoped for. I won't give away the ending, but I will say that he's doing phenomenally well, thanks to all the people that really were there to catch him, if you will, when he did fall through the cracks in the system. And Dr. Dalton obviously can talk more about, kind of how he's doing from a behavioral point of view. But I've kept in touch with Justin. We stopped filming last spring was when we filmed the last footage with him. It's been almost 5 years now.
Yeah, which is kind of the emotional crescendo piece of the film.
Yes,
I won't
yes.
give it away.
Don't give it
is,
away. Yes.
It is very touching. You will enjoy seeing it.
And it's been such an honor to watch this boy from age 14 to 19 turn into this extraordinary young man who the difference, no documentary film camera can even capture exactly how monumental the changes have been for Justin. He's just this incredible. I still think of him as a child, and he's not. He's 19, and he towers over me now. But, you know, when I met him, he was so little and so innocent. And
so scared.
And so lost. Lost and scared. And that is not the Justin now. He is funny and fun and so engaged. You know, I think that he really enjoys learning now. And before, I don't think he ever even knew that that was an option.
Jim.
Yeah, I mean, and I just want to make sure everyone understands that, well, we're proud of the work that we've done in supporting Justin. I mean, this is really Justin's success, and it's Justin who's worked so hard and has gotten to the place where he can work hard and can focus. He's just made wonderful strides. Again, his behavior at this point is very stable. He's able to go to school every day and go through the whole length of a school day, which he was not able to do that before. He wasn't really able to verbally express himself in really any functional way that made sense to anyone as far as communication. And he does a great job of that now. He's able to read, and not like you or I, but he is able to read, and I think you'll actually see him read in the film, which is a touching moment. He is, he's become a resilient young man, and his prognosis for the future, although he will need supports for some time to come, I'm proud to report, are pretty favorable for what we the services that he'll continue to receive and the quality of life that he's going to have. So we're very happy about that.
We are talking about a new documentary called Children of the Dumping Ground, and really about the focus of that documentary, a young man named Justin, who is a child who kind of fell through the cracks and was abandoned by all of the support systems that children should have. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can reach out to us via Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Katie did and find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI. She says, as a provider of mental health services to families in the juvenile system in Indianapolis. My concern is that the current staffing levels at DCES are increasing the chances that more and more kids are falling through the cracks. The state limit is 17 families. Most case managers are at 25 plus. There also seems to be a current shortage of mental health services. There are many issues with the system, and I wish the state would use some of the surplus to better fund services for families in crisis. Karen, you're nodding your head. Is that an affirmation?
Oh, yeah, this isn't TV anymore, right?
It's not a visual medium here. The silent gestures don't work so well.
No, I think that's very well put, and I would agree with that. I think that one of the things I personally have witnessed over the years filming in these confines is the lack of mental health services is really disturbing and wrenching, to be quite honest. There's a statistic right now that over 70% of juveniles in the juvenile justice system nationwide have one or more diagnosable mental health mm-hmm. disorders. 70%. I mean, when you just look at that one statistic alone, and that's just youth, that's not adults. I think we have to be willing to have a public debate about how we best handle mental health services, not only in the state of Indiana, but nationwide. But obviously, since this film was, produced here in Indiana and it's all Indiana based, I can tell you that everyone I worked with on this film said the same thing, that we just don't have enough services or enough staffing for children who present with these issues or have mental health issues. And I do think that is one of the most important reasons for shining a light and taking a camera inside these places, so we can show who these children are and show what the problems are and show what the issues are. Back in 1998, when Chief Justice Randall Shepard first allowed access for my cameras inside these courtrooms, he said it best. And he said, I think that this project is important because we have to start showing these children as real human beings instead of just numbers. And I think right now, when you're talking about mental health problems, you're talking about numbers. It's fine to read about it, but I think it's a different story when you can finally see the faces, in this case, of the children involved. And I think politically, the right thing to do is, look, I'm not a politician, and I don't play one on TV, mm-hmm. but I think that, politically, we need to have a real discussion about resources for mental health issues.
And that is a larger subject about why it is so easy for us to forget these folks,
that's right.
too.
Absolutely.
We've gotten another Facebook question from a listener named Miles, who says, what role did child advocates play in Justin's case?
Jim, and I don't know if you can talk about that or not. It was my understanding, because I was not filming with Justin when he was in court, I did not meet him until he was already in the Department of Correction and placed at Pendleton Juvenile. As far as I know, there was no, he did not have a child advocate. He did not have a guardian. There was no child advocacy involved in his case. I have worked with child advocates in the past. It's a wonderful organization. They do wonderful, wonderful work with children in the system. But from all the research I did on Justin's case, I do not know of any child advocate that worked with him during that time.
We are talking about a new documentary called Children of the Dumping Ground. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. John, welcome to the program. Or is it Joe? Joe, welcome to the program.
Joe, hi.
Hi.
Well, I want you to know that I wasn't going to listen to this, but when Pendleton, my ears perked up, and I had to stop woodworking tools for an hour to listen to this.
Oh, well.
It's been a wonderful show.
Thank you.
And my Fender has already pretty much been stolen, but I've had the opportunity to be at Pendleton before several times as a visitor. It's people of all ages who should be in getting mental help are dumped into places like these. It really brought true, and I really enjoyed listening to you folks. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call, Joe.
Thank you, Joe. And, I think Joe, it's funny that he says he's been there many times as a visitor. He's, I actually think he's one of the lucky ones, if you will, because I think that people, I had a boy one time in Pendleton tell me, Karen, what do people think when they drive by a place like Pendleton? I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, Well, I assume that when people drive by a place like this that's, you know, surrounded by razor wire, they think there's nothing but horrible bad kids inside. And I thought that was a very poignant comment from a boy who was living a life behind bars, who actually was a sweet kid who had a drug problem. He was there on drug issues. But I think that these, so many of these children, Justin obviously being one of them, are, it's out of sight, out of mind. It's so easy not to pay attention because it's a difficult subject to see, to be honest with you.
Has Justin seen the film?
Yes, he has. Yes, he
has. How did he respond to it?
You know, that's a great question. It's a really great question. I have never been so nervous about premiering a show as this one. All the folks at Daymar saw it, and everyone had a chance to comment. And I asked a woman, Sharon, who works with Justin every day at his group home, who does wonderful work with Justin. I said, Sharon, I'm really nervous about Justin seeing this. How do you think he's going to handle it? You're with him the most. And she said, I actually think he's going to be just fine. And I was very, very concerned about him seeing it. I will tell you, at the first part of the film, it was hard for him to watch. Because you have to understand, he's 19 now and a totally different
boy. Well, it's hard
boy.
For everyone to
yes.
watch. I mean, it's moving.
And I think about, you know, if I were to see myself on the screen 5 years ago, I'm a different person now. Yeah. But he did well. He was great, and he ended up being very happy at the end.
And I guess that's a fault. When are the rest of us, other than me, apparently? when is everyone else in Indianapolis who is listening to this going to have a chance to see it?
We expect to have the worldwide premiere in January of 2015. We are still working on the final full theatrical version. Right now, it runs about 53 minutes. By the time we're finished, it'll be about an hour and 10-minute film. When we talk about children, not mm-hmm. child, of mm-hmm. the dumping ground, one of the things that we're doing with the full film is we're making sure that people understand this isn't just happening to one boy in mm-hmm. Indiana. This is happening to tens of thousands of kids across the United States. And so while we did have a private screening here in Indianapolis 2 days ago, by the time it premieres in January of 2015 for the worldwide premiere, you will see kind of the full breadth of this issue coming to the big screen.
And is Justin prepared to be a star?
That's what I told
him.
That's
the other question. Is he?
My editor said he's going to make sure that Justin has two beautiful women on his arm during the red carpet event for the Academy Awards. So we'll see how that goes.
Okay, and we've gotten an email question from a listener named Jen. If you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so. Find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Says, is Justin's outcome typical for children that Daymar treats? And what is Daymar's goal for him and kids like him? Mm-hmm. Jim, I think that
sure.
one should go to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, Justin's outcome is unique, as all the outcomes are unique for each of the children that we have the opportunity and the privilege to be involved with. When you look at, first of all, I think it's so important that as a provider, as anyone monitoring, is that you really have outcomes on your mind. What does make a difference in these kids' lives, and how do we know that there's an actual difference? When we talk about should we invest money, we should invest money and dollars in outcomes, mm-hmm. not in things that sound like outcomes, but in real outcomes. And that's why I think with Justin, what we look at, and with a lot of kids, there are certain things that we know make a difference. You know, within Justin's life, it's connection to at least one adult that is caring, loving, and stable. We know that he has to have some level of efficacy and success in his life. We know that attending school, just attending school every day, is a predictor of a positive outcome for him. You know, Justin is like a lot of kids that we treat. They'll need services and supports for most of their life. Indiana is a state that does provide that for many kids like Justin, but certainly not for all of those that need that. We're still working on that. Justin will receive services as a young adult and into his adult, which could include supervised living in more of a apartment setting or a small home setting where he may live with one or two other individuals that also have similar struggles throughout their life. Daymar's been blessed. About 96% of those that we serve do move on to less restrictive and more productive lives. And I would also just as a plug, one of the things that I think is important for, as far as outcomes go, is that you actually measure those outcomes actively. At Daymar, we measure them one year after we have no more contact with kids or after they have left our residential center, 3 years and 5 years. And that requires that providers stay involved and the supports are there for a prolonged period of time. And we know that that correlates with longer-term sustained success, and that's what we're committed to.
May I ask you a question? I don't think this takes away from the film or from Justin's story. He's got one kind of specific dream that he talks about at the end that I don't want to that I don't want to take away from. But what vision does he have for his life, you know, beyond this? You know, how does he see himself as a 30-year-old man or a 35-year-old man, Karen?
You know, we talk about these things. Ironically, I was just with him on Friday. I took him downtown to see the Christmas lights, and we went out to eat, and we're talking. These are the things that he actually talks about. He talks about them in a different way than you and I would as far as long-term mobility, if you will. But he says things like, I can't wait until I have my own apartment someday. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't think necessarily in terms of I want to get this job and I want to move from this position in this job up the ladder to X. He talks about it in very general terms. and really it's more his, you know, in his mind, it's him living in an apartment on his own, doing things on his own, getting a job, although he won't, you know, necessarily articulate what that job might be. But it's very generalized in that, you know, I can't wait until I have my apartment someday and I can't wait until I, you know, have a job someday. Although it's funny, and you were talking about his dream someday, which we will save until people see the film. If somebody made comment to me, and this is very true, I noticed it. I didn't know if anyone else in the audience would, but he talked about that dream early on when he was 14, what he wanted to do and why he wanted to do it. By the time the film ended, the dream was still the same, but why he wanted to do it was different than when he was 14. And I think that showed, you know, some maturity and some growth with him as time went on.
Oh, we've gotten a very nice email from a listener named Mary. Says, although I have never worked directly with Justin, I speak with him often and enjoy his sense of humor. As an employee of Damar Services, I am grateful to be one of the many individuals who support the children, adolescents, and adults we serve. Thank you, Dr. Dalton, for providing me with the opportunity to do my life's work every day.
That's
got to feel very good.
That feels great. Thank you, Mary.
And you know, I want to echo that. These films would not be possible without people like the folks at Damar and even, you know, the State Department of Corrections and the Department of Child Services. I can't film unless these folks allow me to film. And that's what makes a difference for these kids.
And I think that's a great last word. You're not going to be able to see the film until next year, but it will be out. I'd like to thank my guests, Karen Graw and Jim Dalton. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa David. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.